This is Jerry Nicholson, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 7th of July 2012. Jerry Nicholson, Part 1.
Jerry Nicholson. Date of birth is 26th July 1945.
Where were you born?
I was born in Shoreham-by-Sea in Sussex.
So you're now approaching your 60...
67 this year.
Yeah.
This month, actually.
Okay. And when did you leave Bass?
November 2011.
So last year. So you worked quite. You worked beyond retirement age.
Yes, I did. Yes, I worked. Initially I worked past the 60. I could have gone at 60. The rules changed after that, and then I worked past the 65 for another year and a half. That was mainly to do with trying to complete some work with the aviation regulator.
We'll come to that later, won't we? I'm sure. Yeah. Tell me about your parents. What was your dad?
My dad was a lorry driver down in Sussex. My mother worked as a cleaner. She used to clean at a local convent, used to take me there as a babe. We had quite a good life. It was just the three of us. Lived in a small village called Stenning in Sussex, just in a bowl in the Downs, South Downs. Used to be quite good in those days. If you're a little boy, a little Herbert, you could get together with your mates and go up round the hills, and you could be away all day and no one would worry. Not quite the same these days.
So did you bother with an education of any kind?
I had a mixed education. Failed my 11 plus with glory. Went on to a secondary modern school. I finished up with, I think it was 4 O-levels. Left school at 16 and went to work in a local airport as an apprentice airframe fitter.
Why the fascination with aviation?
Don't know. I'd always been interested in aircraft, always building models of aircraft. And the chance of an apprenticeship. In those days there were lots of apprenticeships. But the apprenticeship at Beagle Aircraft at Shoreham Airport was one that I really fancied. And I did the full 5-year indentured apprenticeship there.
Are you surprised you stayed in aviation all your life?
Not really. I can't say there's anything I've done in aviation that I've really hated. I've always enjoyed the challenges that come with aviation. Be it the aircraft, be it the people you work with, or be it the regulator. Always enjoyed the work, and perhaps that's one of the reasons I stuck with it.
You bagatelled around a little bit with short-term jobs, didn't you?
I did. Once I finished my apprenticeship, it was very difficult. After being there 5 years just over as an apprentice, everybody still viewed you as an apprentice. I stayed on for about another year ostensibly as a skilled fitter, but you were still getting some of the jobs that the apprentices were doing. Yeah. So I got the option to move to another company, work for a real gentleman called George Miles, who was quite a famous aircraft designer. He set up this small company, there was only about 10 of us, and he had some skilled fitters, and we did a lot of intricate work on aircraft, modifying aircraft. We did the first tailplane for the Britten Norman Trilander as an experimental job. I stayed with that for a couple of years, but I got sort of itchy feet, and one of the guys I was working with had just left the Army, REME, Army Air Corps. So I joined REME as an aircraft fitter, had a great discussion with the careers man there. I said, what do you want to be? I told him. He said, well, you can't possibly be.
I said,
well, he wanted me to be a tank man, I think, wanted me to work on tanks and be an armourer, and I suggested that wasn't a good idea because I'd already got a 5-year apprenticeship. So in the end they relented and I went to Middle Wallop for a year for training. Despite my 5-year apprenticeship, I had to do the army training, which was good fun.
Did you learn much?
Patience. Maybe. It was good. It was different. There was different styles of things that we had to do. Came out of there and then did the opposite of what everyone said in the forces. I volunteered for everything. Managed to get secondments, various countries, overseas to Norway, 3 times in Norway, Caribbean, Africa twice, Cyprus in 1974, which was supposed to be a rest after a 5 or 6 month stint in Northern Ireland. But I'd only been in Cyprus 3 weeks when the Turks invaded. So that was quite interesting. We were stuck at Nicosia and we were on the first places to come under attack up there.
Do you want to expand on that? What happened?
Well, I was with the UN forces in Nicosia's, in total about 200 of us looking after the airport. And we had an RAF and an army detachment there with helicopters which supported the United Nations forces. But Nicosia was the first place that the Turkish Air Force went for. It's quite vividly etched on my mind. It was about 4:30 on a Saturday morning when they hit the runways with the first bombs.
Completely without warning?
There was no declaration or anything, but we understood that they were moving. There was some trouble with the EOKA people were coming out onto the streets, causing a few problems, and there were reportedly some incidents with Turkish Cypriots being attacked by the Greek Cypriots and the EOKA people. The Turks said stop, they didn't, so the Turks invaded, basically. I'm sure it was a lot more complicated than that, but... So my 6-month holiday break in Cyprus finished up really pretty much on the green line between the forces. The Turks got as far as Cyprus, Nicosia rather, and stopped. There's a big line across the country which is still there now.
So you were part of the, you were literally holding the line on behalf of the British government, were you?
We were there with the United Nations.
Yeah.
So, know, we were the UN peacekeeping force. I mean, there were Canadians and there were us and there were several other groups. We fought. We were closely linked with the Canadians, shall we say, in Nicosia. And the RAF had a small detachment there with 4 helicopters. We had 4. And we had some, I think there were Coldstream guards there, a couple of hundred that were guarding the airport.
Did you personally come under fire?
Only a couple of times. A bit by accident. I don't think they really understood that we were UN. They tried to break into the UN compound. The Turkish troops had come down from the hills. And the sergeant major said, you know, just stand up and wave your berry. It's not as easy to get up and wave your berry when someone's shooting. But we managed to convince them that we were UN. So they sort of went round us. It was interesting. It was different.
Were you then pulled out, in fact?
No, we stayed there until December.
Right.
We never left Nicosia. We stayed there all through.
Was that a lesson in dealing with adversity?
It was a lesson in keeping your head down at times.
I was going to ask you whether that was a lesson you then later used with Bass, but perhaps that's not appropriate if you kept your head down.
Well, no, I think you're right. I think it is. You know, it's always a good lesson is to look before you do anything.
Yeah.
Just make sure what's going on around you before you leap into something. Always tried to do that. Be careful.
I'm not I haven't got a great knowledge of aircraft types, so I'm not quite sure whether you were dealing mainly with small aircraft or with large aircraft.
No, it was light aircraft.
Light aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in the army before I went to Cyprus, it was small helicopters and a de Havilland aircraft called a Beaver, single engine, which Bass used to use. Mm. And then in Cyprus, it was Sioux helicopters, Bell 42s, which are big glass bubble things, 3 seats, and that's it. But it was all light stuff. The RAF took care of the heavy stuff. We took care of the light stuff.
And had you ever actually learned to fly all of these things?
We were given the chance to fly the helicopters as engineers. Used to be engineer observers in those days, and we used to go flying with the pilots quite a bit, and some of them would let you have a go, but we never had a licence as such. Fixed wing is much easier. And early days with Bass, then certainly the engineers used to do a lot of the flying on the ferry flights because, you know, you're 7-8 hours a day for 10 days to get from the UK round Canada and down South America. So
you're doing that later in your career. You were doing that, were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
A bit later on.
What was your first awareness that there might be a place called the Antarctic in your life?
I mean, you're always aware of it, but I mean, I suppose the first time I ever thought about it was while I was in the army. One of the guys from my unit went off to serve with Bass, and you sort of thought, that sounds okay. I'm not sure about it, but I prefer the cold to the hot. I couldn't get on with the hot in Africa. Mm-hmm. Certainly preferred cold. And then the warrant officer in charge came to me one day. He said, Not sure if you're interested, he said, but there's a place coming up with Bass. Alex Simon, Slim Simon, was leaving Bass and going back to the military. Was I interested? I said, well, yeah, I'd like to give it a go and have a look at what's on offer there. So that was, I think, May time in 76.
Do you have any idea why they approached you?
I think it was just, I don't think they approached me. It was just the guy in the army knew there was a vacancy and he just wondered if anybody at the unit would be interested.
Oh, right, so it was a kind of blanket.
Well, I think the boss came to me because I was one of the single ones there. Right. I was also one of the ones that volunteered for most of the detachments. And I don't know whether he wanted to get rid of me or what it was. But I was offered an interview up at Cambridge, up in All Saints Passage, with Eric Salmon and Alex Simon. It was just as they were moving, actually, from All Saints Passage. I didn't know where they were moving to then. I didn't know they were moving to Madingley Road. Mm. So I got there, and there's these two guys sat on packing cases. And I was a bit concerned that they were doing a runner because they couldn't afford the rent or something. I didn't really know what was going on. So I was on leave at the time. So I said to Eric, whatever you do, I said, don't tell the army until I get back if you're going to give me the job, so that I can talk to them first. He said, yeah, that's fine. Okay, we won't do that. So about 10 days later, I went back to the army at Middle Wallop. At Netherhaven. By then I'd moved. And I'd only just got one foot in the door. And the major was there. Nicholson, my office now. What's the matter, sir? He said, I've just got a posting order here for you for the British Antarctic Survey. He said, what do you know about this? Ah, I was going to tell you about this, sir. But, you know, it sort of went on for about 5 minutes. And then he said, well, actually, he said, if I'd have been you, I'd have done exactly the same. He said, don't come back. Don't forget to come back and tell us, you know, what it's like. And I did. I went back to see them.
But there was already, one gets the impression, there was already kind of a rolling programme of REME people going to the
Army. There was, yes. Yeah, I mean, they'd taken over from the RAF in the very early 70s. And I think there was three or four before me. Rob Campbell, Lent, Alec Foreman, Alex Simon. Probably three. So they'd moved to REME. I don't know whether it was because on the REME side, you tended to do more general stuff. You worked on all the systems, whereas RAF guys generally tended to be airframes, engines, hydraulics or whatever. And they didn't have the sort of the light aircraft background. So it seemed to work quite well. The unfortunate thing was two of us were new when we joined together. Two guys, I joined with the other Army guy, Rob Milburn. And the other two guys that were already there left the same year, so we were thrown in at the deep end, really.
No handover? Half an hour?
Well, yeah, probably half an hour. But it was good.
Not uncommon in Bass, is it?
No, that's right. But it was a challenge, and I suppose really continued to be a challenge from there on.
So what would, in simplest terms, what would your job description have been in 1976 when you got through the door of British Antarctic Survey?
At that stage, I was to go south, fix the aeroplanes and keep it flying. And that was it, basically.
There were two other planes?
Two planes, two engineers. And we were told to fly with them. And you flew everywhere with the aircraft. I mean, my first year we flew down, well, we started to fly down. My first ever flight in a Bass Twin Otter, we had to shut the engine down. Coming out of Toronto, we were taken off on the ferry flight and we started to lose oil pressure on the left-hand engine. So the pilot said, this is not good. What are we going to do? I said, well, the only thing we can do is shut it down. But we were at ferry weight.
So you were full?
Absolutely full of fuel, yeah. So we turned the engine off and we were going down at between 330, 340 feet a minute. We couldn't maintain height. We were asked if we wanted to declare an emergency, but the pilot said, no, we can just make it back to de Havilland's at Downsview, which is what we did on one engine. When we got back, the Pratt & Whitney guy was there, and he said what happened. So we told him, and he knew exactly what was wrong. The engine had just come back off overhaul, and the oil pressure relief valve hadn't been seated properly in its housing. There was a lock ring on the outside of it, which hadn't slotted in, and the valve was moving up and down and dumping oil pressure, and that affects the propeller. So it wasn't just that we were losing pressure to the propeller, the engine was making the aircraft yaw from side to side. So we shut it down, went back, and started again the next day.
Would you classify that as a scary moment?
It was an interesting moment.
Did you fear for your life?
Not really, no. It's funny because the guy I was flying with, Giles Kershaw, I'd never met the guy before. He turned up at the hotel two nights before we took off, and I felt comfortable with him straight away. And once we took off and were flying, I again, you know, really comfortable. You get that feeling with the pilot, and you get used to the guy fairly quickly, and he was good. And the more I flew with him, actually, the more I liked it. I did about 6 years with him in the end, and I would have flown anywhere with him. In fact, I did. You know, we went all over the place. But no, he was very, very good. I mean, he was there calmly talking to air traffic, saying, you know, this is what we're going to do. Do you wish to declare an emergency? I mean, he's talking over the radio saying, no, I've got the window open, shouting yes. But I mean, it's... No, it was good. We went... probably one of his better landings, actually, on one engine. But I'd never tell him he made a good landing.
Tell me more about Giles, because he was quite a big figure, wasn't he, in the air service in the Antarctic?
Until, he was.
Until his own demise, sadly.
That's right. That was very sad. I mean, you know, of all things, he flies an autogyro. But, I mean, that's by the by. But, I mean, he was a way-out sort of guy. If there was anything he could do that would push things to the limit, then he would do it. But he would always push it to the limit, and it was always calculated. He would never do anything. I mean, having said that, then you've got the autogyro incident. But he would never really do anything that would endanger the aircraft, you, him, whatever. I mean, later on in my career, we did some long flights, which were pushing the boundaries a bit with the Twin Otter. But, you know, he worked it all out. We sat down and looked at it, and he said, you know, he can do this. Look at it, and you think, yeah, it looks good. He's calculated it, and, yeah, we can do that. He was a really nice guy. I got on very well, very, very well with him. And I think we had a little bit of respect for each other. Probably he didn't have as much respect for me as I did for him because I was a greasy engineer, but, I mean, you know... he was the one that asked me to go on Transglobe after I finished my first 3 years with Bass. So I flew with him again there for two or three years.
Did you fly with him then to relieve Belgrano after the famous winter? When the three FIDs were stuck in Belgrano?
I don't think it was me, no.
No, okay.
Because that was Gary Studd, wasn't it? I was there when they were left. I mean, I was the engineer on the flight that flew out.
Came and come out.
To go back and... with the theory was take some people out, then go back and get them.
Why didn't you go back?
Well, my recollection is that the pilots wanted to, but we were dissuaded from doing so because it was so late in the season. And they did, people, shall we say management, didn't want to get the aircraft stuck. So there was a lot of discussions over whether or not they should go back. I flew with Giles into Belgrano in some terrible weather. It was Giles and the doctor on board to pick up a guy with a stomach problem. It later turned out that we found him having steak and chips when we got into Morambio, but, I mean, it wasn't much of a problem. We just wanted to get out. But, I mean, you know, I didn't see why we couldn't have gone back and got them. And I think perhaps Gary Stubb was of the same opinion, that we could have gone back and got them. But, you know, we were told, no, don't go back because A, B and C is going to happen and the Russian ship's going to pick them up and they're going to be fine. So with everything sort of arranged by headquarters, we decided that, you know, we could leave, or it was decided that we could leave. So we left, and it was while we were en route that we found that the ship had gone straight by and left them there. I never did find out why the ship didn't pick them up, but the Russian ship, I can't remember which one it was now, but it was supposed to pick them up. It had gone by Belgrano and was going back out again. Dog hasn't let me forget that, actually, Dog Holden. He did remind me again last year at the reunion.
He's quite animated about it even now, isn't he? Yes, I've interviewed Dog. So was that part... I mean, you talk in your notes about the complications of trying to micromanage air teams from 9,000 miles away. So Bass were making decisions on your behalf, even though they weren't there.
Yeah, I mean, they tend to do that.
And therefore they err to caution.
They don't... I don't know. It always seems to be... You have to be very careful here, I suppose, but it always seems to me that other people seem to know better what is the right thing to do without being on site. Communications have changed a lot now, of course, and there's a lot more communication before decisions are made. But in those days, you know, it was more a case of, you know, you do as you're told, and if you're told to leave or do this or do that, you do it. You know, and if the weather's bad here, then you wait for A, B or C or whatever you want to do. Whereas today, there's a lot more information available to people on site to make decisions. There's a lot more technology there to help you. And if, you know, you can't get into one site, then you can look at other jobs and see what you can and can't do. And you can offset the load. And I think to a degree, the management's changed slightly. The micromanagement was probably a lot earlier on in my career, the earlier days of Bass. It's not to say it doesn't happen still. There are instances when things happen, you know, and perhaps even the air unit in Cambridge don't agree with what's being said and laid down by the guys down south, but you have to go along because that's the party line, if you like.
So the call is now much more centred in the Antarctic itself rather than in Cambridge. If a decision had to be made, the final decision is base leader, is it?
Well, it's the base leader. If it's an air unit decision, then the chief pilot now has a great say in what goes on. Field ops manager, chief pilot, and the base commander will sit down and discuss things. And it's much better. You don't get as much, you know, you will do. It's can you do or will you consider doing this? Which is good, you know, because it does... It allows the chief pilot, certainly, to use all the options that he's got available to him. And we do have, you know, Bass. Still difficult after 6 months to stop saying we. But, you know, Bass, with four aircraft, four twin otters anyway, have a much more flexibility of operations in the Antarctic now. And the Dash 7's made a great deal of difference. You know, you can get flights every other day if you wanted to, if the weather allows you to. Whereas we used to have the ship in at the end of the season, the same as all the other, you know, bases and everything else. There's much more flexibility there now.
So, back to 1976, and you were given the nod that you were going to go south.
Yeah.
And then, at that point, were you told where you were going to go? Or did that come later?
We knew where we were going. Once I got the job, I knew where I was going. That was part of the interview. They told me then that I'd be going to Adelaide. And then that during that season, we'd be moving round to Rotherhithe. What they didn't tell me was that the first job we were going to do was, in fact, over on the Ross Ice Shelf, which was a little further on than Rotherhithe.
Yes.
We got to Rotherhithe after, I think it was like a 10-day ferry flight, which in itself was something quite major for the two of us as engineers. We'd never done one of those before, and nor one of the pilots. One of the pilots, Pete Prattis, was new to us. And Pete was a Shackleton pilot, and he came in and he did his initial ski landing. Was the first landing he ever made at Adelaide. So
you literally came down the planet, stopping every night on the way.
Yeah.
B&B.
Yeah. Very much. I mean, we were lucky in those days. We picked the aircraft up in Canada, De Havilland serviced the aircraft, so we went and picked both aircraft up in Toronto. Rob Milburn and myself, the other engineer, had just been on a conversion course at De Havilland's for the Twin Otter, so we had some basic idea of what the Twin Otter was like. We saw our first Twin Otter, and then days later we got into it and flew 8,000 miles in the thing.
Gosh.
It was about a 10-day ferry flight. 9 or 10 days, can't remember now. It used to be 12 from the UK and 10 from Canada. So, yeah, it was... It was good, it was interesting. You know, you learned a lot about the aeroplane en route. You learned a lot of what it could do. You learned how the weather changes and can affect what you're doing. And we flew straight into Adelaide to be met by a reception committee at Adelaide, which was a bit scary. There was a judge, a doctor, the biggest syringe I've ever seen, a lawyer, a banker, I think. I don't know. There was a load of people behind a big desk up on the skiway. They wanted all their money. They wanted to give us all injections. They wanted to do all sorts of things to us in the first... We were beginning to wonder if we'd gone to the right place.
This is the kind of crossing the line type thing.
Absolutely, yes. You know, and it was interesting. We finished up working the first night. We had a bit of a problem with one of the aircrafts, so we worked on that. We stayed around, Giles and I stayed around for about a week, I think. Flew over to Rothera. Said hello to the first four guys ever to winter there. Messrs. Hurley, Horton, Turner and Sheldon. And then we went back to Adelaide. And we took off for, I think we went through Cypel on the first way, off to the McMurdo, work out on the Ross Ice Shelf with the Americans. Bob Thomas was the lead there. He was an old Bass geologist, and he was leading this American party. And we supported this 10-man party for the best part of 2 months out at Roosevelt Island.
Was that part of the original plan?
Yeah.
You knew that was going to happen. It just seems unusual baptism.
I didn't know until way into the start of the whole operation. I didn't know straight away. And it was only once we were getting ready to leave that they said, oh, and by the way, we're going to do this and this. Things are a bit better now. There's a plan before you go, which everybody's aware of, and you all know what's happening. But, it was pretty good. We went to the Americans and... You know, they said, well, we've not supported one of these aircraft before. What do you want? We said, well, you know, nothing really. A heater and perhaps some ground power. And I finished up with a ground power unit that had a bigger aero engine in than we had on the Twin Otter wing. It was just amazing.
It was very early in your time in the Antarctica. What were the significant differences between a British base and an American base? Apart from the fact that they had lots more money.
Size. I mean, to go into McMurdo, there were thousands of people there.
Really?
Yeah, there were thousands. I don't know, in those days, 3,000-4,000 people there. But it was a massive place. You had Starlifters taking off, C-141s taking off on the sea ice. You know, you had Hercules coming around. We used to have a Hercules came around twice a week, dropping off fresh vegetables and salads and stuff out onto the Ross Ice Shelf. And it was doing a round robin to the other parties that were out. Oh, it's just incredible. You know, there was so much stuff there. And you think back to Adelaide and sleeping in the hut there, Black Adders. I mean, it was like moving from a shanty to a major hotel. You know, I mean, it was... But, you know, having said that, and I liked Adelaide, I thought that was... Although I wasn't there very long, I did like Adelaide. And as it turned out, Adelaide initially was better than Rothera. I mean, was it 43, 44 of us sleeping in the one hut at Rothera when we got round there while they were building the new first part of the new station? I think it's the Chippy's shop now. We had one room for sleeping in where the bunks were three high. They were piled everywhere. There was no room. There was nothing. And one room for eating and working. Well, not working, but, you know, having meetings and stuff in to decide what we're going to do for the day.
We're leaping about a bit. That's okay. But let me just take you back to... being on the American side of the Antarctic, there's a reference here, one of the most difficult seasons, which is your first season, you always say it's your best season, but the most difficult because you were trying to fulfil two briefs at once. You're on the American side of the Antarctic, yet dealing with problems on the British side as well.
Yeah, I mean, we had a few problems with the other aircraft. The other aircraft that was left at Adelaide damaged a ski, and Bass, and only Bass could do it, managed somehow to get a ski from Canada down to McMurdo for us to take back in the Twin Otter to Adelaide. They damaged a ski beyond repair on the aircraft, so we took another ski back. We had to fly all the way back, went via Pole this time and then into Rothera, fitted, helped fit the ski, got the aeroplane flying again, and then we flew back to Roosevelt Island on the Ross Ice Shelf, and we started work there again. I suppose we'd only been there about a matter of weeks, And they managed to damage the aircraft beyond repair at Gomez Non-Attack. So we had to fly back then from McMurdo.
Was that an American aircraft?
No, that was the other BAS aircraft. So there's only one of us left by this stage. So we flew the remaining Twin Otter back to... Gomez Non-Attack via South Pole. Picked up three of the guys that were with the aeroplane and then flew them on the other 400 miles to Rothera. And then the rest of the season we spent recovering the field parties that were out and recovering what we could from the aircraft at Gomez Non-Attack.
How badly damaged was it?
It was written off. Right. We managed to get the engines out and, he twisted the fuselage. He tried to land between two non-attacks, but missed the coal in the... Well, he didn't miss it. He missed C in the coal in the middle, and he slammed into the coal in the middle of the two non-attacks. Pulled up at the last moment, but the undercarriage was damaged and the wings and the tail. And it was obvious that being that far from base, we couldn't repair it, and it was pretty badly bent. So we took off whatever we could.
Had the crew been lucky?
Well, there was only one cut, and that was, I think, to a chin caused by a skidoo handle in the back of the aeroplane.
Right.
So I think, yeah, it was reasonably lucky. But they managed, I think there was some discussion as to how it had happened. But, I mean, at the end of the day, the weather wasn't that good. I think the decision was made to continue flying rather than turn back. Now, whether that's the right or wrong decision, we'll never know. We recovered most of the stuff from the aeroplane. And then we took the remaining aircraft back. The other guys went out on the ship. That was it.
But good start. Sorry?
It was a good start to my career. Busy.
The overall theme of your first year, though, seems to have been primarily trying to transfer, the beginnings of the transfer from Adelaide to Rothera.
Yeah, I mean, the operation was initially from Adelaide, and then part of it happened while I was away on the Ross Ice Shelf, but we moved to the skiway at Rothera, and that became the base there and until the runway in way, way a lot later. The first move, the first season was busy. There was a lot of movement going on with people getting ready to move the base around, with us going away, with the field season still to be maintained, with the incidents that we had, having to fly backwards and forwards, adding days and miles to your flying. And it became... It actually seemed a very short season because it was so busy. It was really a good season. As I say, I was flying with Giles most of the time. And that was really good. I found it very, very good fun. I really enjoyed it.
What happened to your feet?
My feet?
Trapped under a pedal.
That was on... Yes. That was another season.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. We were on takeoff, or trying to take off from Rothera to come home at the end of the season. I think that was 80... That must... Not 80, 70. Must have been 77, 78 season. So it must have been sort of February 78, I can't remember. We didn't manage to take off. We'd had some bad weather and there's some large ridges around the airstrip, the skiway, and we managed to jump from one to the other without actually getting over them, and we hit one and there was a nasty noise from the front of the aeroplane, and we hit another two and then the floor came up and my feet, which were out of the way for the pilot, actually became... tangled with the floor and the pedals.
Was that dodgy?
No, I just... It wasn't inextricably stuck in there, or it wasn't, but I don't know if it was fear or what it was, but I managed to get my feet out anyway by the time Ray Ady arrived on the Skidoo. I'm afraid I went in the quotes book that day. He asked me what the technical damage was, and I told him in some Anglo-Saxon that it was very broken. And he responded that that wasn't very technical. I said, well, that's the best you're getting at the moment. It was as I was stepping out, and I wasn't very happy because we weren't going home. But he came up to me in the bar and we had a long chat about it afterwards. So that was all right. And I apologised.
So was that plane your only means of getting out of the base that winter?
No. We had... The plane was then dismantled. We had 2 weeks to get it on the ship. We took it apart, put it on the ship, and we came out with the ship and the aeroplane to Monty.
So that was the end of the first season?
Second season. Yeah.
But the first season, you the Americans obviously thought quite highly of you because you got their polar medal.
Yes, I did. But I think you get that for just for being on the ice down there, don't you?
Oh, I see. I don't know.
I think so. I don't think there was anything great about it. But I got a state for, you know, what do you call it, a citation from the State Department. It was quite funny, actually, because I think it was about 2 or 3 years later, I had to go back to Rimi for a day for a parade. And I had this American polar medal. And I know that you can wear foreign decorations. And it was issued by State Department. So I showed the orderly room this citation. I said, "Can I wear this?" "Oh, we don't know about that. I don't think so." I said, "Well, yeah, it's awarded by a foreign government. Why not? We'll send it down to London." So it went down to London. No, we didn't get a response until after the parade, so it didn't really matter. But it just seemed that they couldn't handle that sort of thing.
Beyond their experience.
Yeah, they tell you you can wear them, but then when you get them... It was quite interesting.
So, did you then, at the end of each season, were you coming back to the UK? You weren't wintering in the Antarctic?
No, we used to do 6 months down there and then back for 6 months.
Because I guess there was no winter flying. So.
That's right. Yeah, the flying stops in end of February, early March. The weather gets a bit bad there.
So how was that for you? Because if you were commuting between Antarctic and UK for 3 years, was that kind of an interesting psychological conundrum for you?
Well, I got 2 summers every year.
Yeah.
Which was good. No, I mean, when I came back here, I worked in, I think my first summer, I worked in the garage with the vehicle mechanics, helping with skidoos and stuff, new skidoos and getting them ready to go south. We didn't have much to do with the aeroplanes because they were looked after by de Havilland's. All we had to do really was go and pick them up at the end of the summer, go and check them out and make sure we were happy, get ready for the departure. I got to do quite a few bits and pieces that I hadn't done. I got to play lots of cricket in the summer, which was good. it was good because it gave us a chance to come into Bass. And that's where I started to see what goes on or what went on then at Bass, you know, and if we'd asked for a nut and bolt from down south, how it was ordered, where it went through, what the process was. So that started to be quite good. You could understand things. I mean, my first season south, I got a wonderful lecture from Big Al Smith. I was walking across the beach at Rothera while they were doing the building and I saw something bend down, picked it up, and it was a bent 6-inch nail. I put it down again. As I put it down, Big Al was there. "What are you doing?" I said, "You know, it's bent." He said, "Do you know how much that cost to get it down here?" And then I had a massive lecture from him, and they're the sort of things you remember. Especially from Big L.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was good.
Just picking out some other incidents, I mean, in your notes, the word crash appears quite frequently.
Yeah, I probably got the Jonah title.
There was a double engine failure over the Ronnie Ice Shelf.
Oh, that was very well controlled. That wasn't a crash, yeah. I mean, that was very good. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
We were working out of the Theron Mountains with an American geosiever team. And we were moving them from the Therons. I can't remember whether we were going into the Shackleton Range. I think we were. And we took off. And we'd been going for about 40 minutes. And one of the engines just shut itself down. So I got called into the front with the pilot, Gary Studd. And he said, "You know, what do we do?" I said, "Well, try and start it. We can't start it. We'll turn around and go back towards Belgrano," which is where we were based at the time. And so we turned back towards Belgrano. We'd just gone across the chasm bit, and the second one stopped. So it's all quiet in the front, and we're looking at each other, sort of, okay. And now this is where we differ. Gary says one thing, and I say the other. He said to me, "What are we going to do?" And I said, "Land." But if you talk to Gary, I said, "What are we going to do?" And he said, "Land." But I'm sure it's my way around. But whatever way, he made probably the best landing of that season. That he'd had a bit of an issue landing the aeroplane, but he took it in onto the Ronnie Ice Shelf first time. Beautiful landing.
How much time do you have?
Deciding
to land and landing without due with anyone.
Well, we had a couple of minutes because it was definitely going down.
Yeah.
Its glide characteristics of the Twin Otter are not very good. So we were going to land anyway. One of the coolest people, actually, was the radio operator at Rothera. What's his name? Alf Cheshire. We lost an engine, Alf. We're going back to Belgrano. Check that, lost an engine. And then he said, well, we've lost the second engine. Yep, check that, lost the second engine. Well, sound a bit more concerned at least. But there was nothing, you know. And when we landed, yeah, on the ground. Yeah, check that, on the ground at. And he gave us a time. Well, I don't know what was going on back in the radio room. But
so yeah. how do you land an engine with no power in the Antarctic on ice in 2 minutes?
In a straight line. You just have to pick your spot and hope that it's flat, which is what he did. And he picked a good spot and we landed. I mean, there was a quick discussion, which he led and I agreed. And that was it, really. With one engine, you're always looking. If you've lost an engine, you're always looking at what's coming up. So he was looking around and he was keeping his eye on what was going on. And he, like Charles, another very good pilot. And, we landed on, got out and had a look around, decided there were no holes around us, and put the tent up and I started to strip the fuel system, and there was a lot of water in there, well, a lot of ice in there, frozen in there. We picked up some fuel at Belgrano and there must have been some water in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it didn't show in the tests. We do tests on the fuel before we put it in the tanks. We do checks of the filter housings before we start the engines, but we didn't find any, and we didn't find any more. We drained the whole system out. The Russians came up with some more fuel, and we drained all our fuel out, put their fuel in, and we never found any water at all. They were amazed they couldn't find any, but I had the filters full of it, filter housings, so I was in the tent sort of drying all those out, hanging them up in the roof and put new filter bowls and stuff and put new filters in. And yeah, we then, Gary and I, took the aeroplane back to Belgrano.
So how long were you grounded for?
I think it was probably about a day and a half while we had the bits and pieces there. It wasn't long.
How did you take off again?
Well, we walked the route first, sorted out a decent route, knocked out any lumps and that were in the way, and then just took off as best we could, picked a strip and went along there.
And the decision to go back to Belgrano, was that because you had to get fresh fuel?
Well, we were going to get some new fuel and check it all out again, make sure the engines were still working. Everybody else went back in the other three that were with us went back in a helicopter. Russian helicopter took them back, so it was just the two of us took the aeroplane back.
Okay, was that a risky thing to do?
I didn't think so, no. I mean, we tested the engines on the ground. We got the fuel, but there was no water in the fuel. We're quite happy with that. But it does concentrate the mind next time you fuel up anywhere. You know, you're very... We were always very careful about the fuel. And I don't actually know how it got in there. But it did. And somehow, we had this issue where it went very quiet. It was just this little sort of high-pitched whine in the aeroplane, which I couldn't quite work out until I looked round and saw one of the guys in the back going... He wasn't very happy that he'd gone quiet outside.
I've got some questions or some notes from Rod Arnold here, who took over from you as the head of Bass Air Unit many years later. He wants to know a bit more about moving aircraft ops from Adelaide to Rothera. What were the complications in shifting ground control, I guess, what he means by this, from Adelaide to Rothera?
I mean, ground control in those days was just a radio. I mean, there was not the tower like we've got now at Rothera. You know, we've got an ops tower at Rothera now where there's all sorts of radio communications gear, weather gear, everything's in there, beacons and everything else. I think we had a beacon at Adelaide, an NDB, a non-directional beacon, but I think we bought a new one at Rothera when that went in. So when Rothera was open, we had a new beacon and that was it, really. There was very little to move.
You weren't head of air traffic unit at that point, so did you have much input into what facilities were provided at Rotherham?
Not really, no. We were just army guys on short secondment, and we were told what was going to be there. You know, we were told there'd be a beacon. You know, if we thought we could find something that was better, or if we had something that we knew we used in the army that was better, we could suggest it, and it was given consideration. But generally, we were just told that, you know, you'll have A, B, and C. And this is worked with the guys before. Whether the guys before, the previous season, Alec Foreman and Alex Simon, had much input into it, I don't know. But they were the experienced guys, so they may have had some input into what was needed at Rotherham. But, I mean, basically all we had was a beacon and a radio, and, I mean...
Was that enough? Were you not worried about the lack of facilities?
Not really, no. I mean, that was enough. It had worked before, you know, and it seemed to work quite well while we were there. We had some bits and pieces that helped us. Later on, we got some beacons that you could pick up on the weather radar on the aircraft so that they would tell you, you know, where you were. You could see the landscape on the weather radar as well. I'd had a mapping mode, and you see the beacon. That was like a reassuring sign that the main beacon was working okay, and you were homing on the NDB. It was all pretty basic stuff, but then there was very little else, unless, as I say, you went to somewhere like McMurdo, where we were given a full radar approach one day. I mean, we never saw the ground until we were, I don't know what it was, 300, 250 feet above the ground. We were talked down all the way by this very nice lady on the radar and right onto the end of the runway. It was great.
She could not do it Rotherham, I presume.
No. I mean, this is like a big military base. McMurdo then, Williams Field.
Were you involved in building the skiway at Rotherham?
Not really, no. Main involvement there was trying to get what we wanted in the hangar. We were obviously limited by funding. But, you know, we wanted various bits and pieces around the hangar so that we could set up shop fairly quickly. And when I left last year, we were still working to get what we wanted at the hangar. I mean, it is all a matter of funding, you know, and at the moment, the hangar there is probably the best facility in the Antarctic. There's no doubt about that, having the hangar and all the kit that we've got there. And all the people that come through there, I mean, you know, sometimes there's, I don't know, what, 12, 13 aircraft there, visiting aircraft while ours are away. Lots of people, the contractors, come through with their aircraft. They stop there, fit their skis, use the jacks, use the facilities. You know, it's a good building. It's a good place to be.
And were you, because that was a bit later, were you influential in deciding what went into the hangar and what didn't?
We certainly drew up a lot of lists of what we wanted in the hangar. Yeah. We didn't get all of it, but we got quite a lot. Yeah.
So Bas was listening to the men on the ground, or the men in the air, in this instance.
They started to, yeah. I mean, it was we were becoming more of a professional unit. It was a larger unit, and we were also, at that stage, having good professional chief pilots. Good guys were there. I'm not decrying the efforts of those before. But, you know, by the time we got the runway, we had the Dash 7, though it didn't come into service until 94. And we had, you know, 8 pilots, 5 engineers, and a couple of us at Bass, 3 of us at Bass. So it was becoming quite a large unit, so we had a bit of a say in bits and pieces and what we wanted.
How did the runway come about? What was the thinking behind doing that, and what role did you play in that? This is David Drury's era, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, the runway, we always wanted somewhere that was going to be safe. I rejoined Bass in 82 permanently. And in the end of the 81 season was when the 2 aircraft were blown over on the skiway at Rotherham. And that was one of the key drivers, if you like, for getting a hard runway and a hangar. Protecting the aircraft, protecting the assets that we did have. And that was one of the arguments used. And although that happened in 81, 82 season, it wasn't until 90, 91 we got the runway. and the hangar. It took quite a time to get the money and get it all arranged. It was a 2-year project and it took quite a while. But the main drive there was to protect the aircraft and to and to give the engineers, the little dears now, somewhere to work in comfort. Although we didn't put any heating in it. It would have cost too much to heat the hangar. No, I mean, it was protect the aircraft, really, protect the asset. And let's face it, they're a valuable asset when you're down there. You need to look after it.
Is it long enough?
The runway?
Mm.
It was designed as an emergency runway for Hercules. It's certainly long enough for us, and it's certainly long enough for the Dash 7. Yeah, I mean, if you wanted anything bigger in there, then you'd have a problem. I think the RAF have looked at it once. They did some work. They did an overflight. But I don't know how serious that was taken. Yeah, it's ideal for what we do and what Brad's doing at the moment.
So what was the thinking behind the Dash 7? Was that your idea or...?
Wasn't my idea, no. I mean, we were looking at... there was an aircraft committee, a group, that were looking at how to enhance the operation. And it was decided that if we could find an aircraft with more than 2 engines, had to have a minimum of 3. We were looking at a variety of aircraft in those days to see if we could get, you know, the 1,000 miles across water from the Falklands or from South America and carry people in and move stores about within the Antarctic. At the time, we wanted a ski-equipped aircraft. As it turned out, we didn't get that, but we did get the Dash 7, and we could use the Dash 7 onto the ice runway at Sky Blue. There are other ice runways that we could use, although they are a bit further afield. And at the moment, we use the Dash 7, or Bash use the Dash 7 to... like a hub and spoke operation, you fly everything into Sky Blue and take it out from there with the Twin Otters, and it saves a lot of time. You know, you put fuel into Sky Blue at a drum for a drum with the Dash 7. If you do it with a Twin Otter, it's 13-1. So the economics of that alone are...
Sorry, I don't quite clearly follow that.
Well, if you fly, say you fly 14 drums of fuel into Sky Blue with a Dash 7, you burn 14 drums of fuel to get it there in the aircraft.
Right.
So you, it's one for one to get it there. If you fly it in with a Twin Otter, you've got a stage at Fossil Bluff. So you have to build a pyramid at Fossil Bluff and then fly on to Sky Blue. And by the time you've got one drum to Sky Blue, you've burnt something like 13 drums in the Twin Otter.
Yeah, so the economics, sorry.
The economics there.
Did the Dash 7 choose itself, or did you have to sort of shop around for it?
We looked around at various aircraft. We looked at twin engine, we looked at 3-engine aircraft. And, you know, the Dash 7 was... probably the lead aircraft of all of those. It had 4 engines. It had good short field performance. You know, the comfort there of 4 engines carrying people in and out of the Antarctic is great. And the short field performance is excellent on the aircraft. You know, the project to fit skis was quite a long one. And perhaps more protracted than some of us would have liked. We knew straight away the skis were going to be heavy.
Hmm.
And, I mean, the specification was you'd have to fly, I think, 1,250 nautical miles, carry 5,000 pounds of freight or passengers, you know, have skis, do this, do that. And there was a series of things that we had to do. And it was never, ever going to be... The Dash 7 was never going to be capable of carrying that amount of cargo with skis. The skis were massive to support that weight of aircraft. You're looking at 22 tons when it's fully laden, so it's quite a big aircraft. Mm. The skis were big, and they would have had to put the undercarriage down, keep it down, slow the aeroplane down. So we went on for a long while and got a full design study done on the skis. Perhaps we went a bit too far. Perhaps it was a step too far. It was done, and we got the Dash 7 in service eventually. We had a few problems modifying it.
What did you have to do to it?
We had to put a cargo door in it. We retrofit a cargo door. We had to put new avionics in it. There were some modifications that we were supposed to do, but we found out at the very last minute that the aircraft we bought actually had the mods in but weren't declared by de Havilland's. So we had to go through all the process with de Havilland's of getting Bombardier at the time for getting these things officially declared as being fitted to the aeroplane, which saved money, but just took a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to satisfy the regulators that we could fly onto ice and we could do A, B and C with it. But the regulators then weren't as difficult to deal with as perhaps ASSI. It was a long process. It took us about 3.5 years, I think, from getting the aeroplane to actually putting it into service.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
The time the mods were all done.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was. I mean, the long-range tanks on the aeroplane, you carry 8,000 pounds of fuel in wing tanks inboard of the engines, between the engines and the fuselage. And the tanks were already there. Another mod, not declared by de Havillands. But when we went to try them with fuel, they leaked. So all the sealant in the tanks had to come out and the tanks had to be resealed. And when that was done, they leaked again, so it all had to be taken out a second time. But to do this, you have to go in through a little hole in the centre of the wing and climb along the wing into the fuel tanks. And it's a terrifying job. I, fortunately, being of my stature, was unable to get in there. So they employed some small people to do it. One of them, unfortunately, very unfortunately, suffered a claustrophobic attack one day when he was in the wing. And there was all sorts of discussions on how to get him out. He actually froze in the wing. We couldn't get him out. And there was talk of cutting the wing and sawing the wing and doing all sorts of things. And Paul Whiteman, who was in charge of the operation, was beginning to get a bit panicky, I think. He thought they were going to saw the wing off at one stage. But finally a medic got there, gave the guy an injection, relaxed him, and we managed to drag him out across all the ribs in the wing.
Gosh.
And get him out of the wing. So he didn't go back in again.
Was he a BAS employee?
No, he was from the company.
Right.
But it was just a long, drawn-out process.
That was much longer than you expected, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. We expected the thing to be, a year, 18 months at the most. We expected to buy it 1 year, miss that season, and then get the following season.
Was David Drury doing his head in? What were you doing your head in?
I was, at the time, I was looking after the four twin otters and Paul Whiteman was looking after the Dash 7. So, I was very anxious to get the thing in service because obviously we've been pushing for this larger aircraft to support the operation. And I mean, when it did come into service, you've only got to look at it. I mean, it's 5 hours against 5 days on the ship. So, it's been invaluable since we've got it. And it's working very well, but it is only a wheels-only aeroplane, and there were other aircraft around, three-engine aircraft, but it was based on the old Dakota, and it's a 60, 70-year-old aeroplane, which people are selling you as a brand-new aeroplane with three engines for $4, 5, 6 million. Mm. Do you really want to get into that? And the answer is most of the people down there now are. There's lots of people flying them down there now. There's 6 or 7 operating.
The Dakotas or the Dashes?
Dakotas, there are. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the Dakota three-engine. They're Basler turbos, tri-turbos they're called. They're very good. I'm not entirely sure they would be ideal for Bass. I think some of the operations down there are perhaps not as regulated as we are.
We'll come to that later. We've leapt a bit again, but that's okay, because obviously we've now got you having left the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. But before we dismiss them completely, I was just interested in whether they were a benefit to Bass, a boon for Bass, and why there was a change to a civilian support system.
I mean, the engineers were good. We used to get some really good guys. The guys that came in, I'll be careful here, I'm not playing my own trumpet, but the guys that came in were sergeants and they'd had experience, so all of us that went to Bass had to be at least the rank of sergeant, so you'd had some experience of light aviation, you've had some experience of living around in various areas that perhaps weren't as comfortable as hotels and bits and pieces, so it was good, and the military get it done attitude was good. We kept the engineers going as long as we could.
What changed?
Regulations tended to change and it became difficult. What we used to do and try and do was get our engineers a civilian licence, and that used to take us 2 and a bit years. And once we got the licence, the third engineer, we had 3 engineers at that time, We used to stagger them so that they changed one each year. And by the time they got to their third year, they had a licence. They were in charge of the other two, and they were cleared to sign off the work and oversee the others. And then, in their infinite wisdom, the authorities decided it should take longer to get your licence, and you'd only get parts of it, and you couldn't do this and you couldn't do that. And it became very complicated.
Which authority are we talking about?
It was the Civil Aviation Authority then. In 2003, that became ASI. ASI took over responsibility for the overseas territories. They, if we hadn't have been going with civilian engineers by then, fully, I think they would have insisted. It was the change in regulations rather than anything else.
Was this just red tape, or could you see some logic behind all this?
I couldn't see any logic behind it, no, because right. The engineers didn't change. They didn't get any better. In fact, some of the civilian engineers that we had weren't as good as the army engineers. Having said that, some were very good. Some had a lot of years on Twin Otters and a lot of years on Dash 7. We always had civilian engineers for the Dash 7 anyway, because of its size and the fact that the army guys didn't get a licence for that size aircraft. Or couldn't get a licence for that size aircraft. So it was... The regulations drove us away from Remy engineers for the Twin Otters. It works well now. We've got a company there now that we've had some good engineers down there. But it's the same as anything, you know, good and bad. Some would say the same about, you know, what they had in 76 when the two of us joined. You know, they'd gone from two good guys and they suddenly got two bad guys. One of them was a jinx, but I mean, you know.
So the transition period then from using army engineers to the civilian engineers, was that also fraught with trouble, or was that a very smooth transition because they were the same guys effectively?
It wasn't a major issue.
Right.
We did it slowly, and we took our time, sorted it all out, and we got a decent company to work with us, and the engineers went south and it was okay.
Ron Arnold seems to think that the Remy guys were much more than just air mechanics. They were,
yeah, they were everything. I mean, being in the army, you know, when you're in a small unit, you're an engineer, you're a storeman, you're a fireman. You know, you're all sorts of things on the unit. Whereas the civilian engineers are tied by liability, they will only do what they're contracted to do, which is mend the aeroplanes. Mm. You know, so it then became difficult for us to get anybody to become firefighters on the runway.
Yeah.
So we then started taking the base guys or the base GAs and, you know, various guys, tractor mechs. We trained them with a CAA firefighting course and put them down there. But it took a bit away from the air unit. So, you know, these guys, although we try to get them to do as much as possible, it is very difficult. And we do have to realise, or BAS have to realise, that, you know, they are only contracted to do engine maintenance or the aircraft maintenance.
So they don't adhere to the BAS everybody mucking together
I think
approach.
You can get lucky and you get the good guys that will, you know, but they're doing it off their own bat. They're not doing it through the company. Mm. They do it because they're there and they want to do it. But you don't always get that sort of guy.
And I have to ask you about Parker Watch, the entertainment manager of the air unit, a chap called Steve Parker.
Steve Parker, yeah.
I see there is a reason.
No, he's a great guy. I worked with him for nearly 20 years. He's ex-RAF. And he came to join us as the guy to look after the Twin Otters and be one of our headquarters engineers. But he's a great, great party guy. He really is. He loves to party. But, you know, give him a due. He parties hard. He works very, very hard. Parties hard, but he's always first one at breakfast. He's just a great guy to work with. He really is. You know, I had some fun with him over the 20 years or 19 years that we worked together. He'll probably tell you different, but...
I'm sure he will.
He's a good guy, but he is a bit of a party animal. And Parker Watch used to be, tonight you're on Parker Watch, you have to make sure that he comes back to the hotel or wherever, you know, and
chaperone.
Yes, you have to look after him. But I mean, it was like trying to catch an eel in a bucket of grease. You couldn't get near him. You know, once he went into party mood, that was it. He was away. And if you blinked, you'd lost him. And if you lost him, you didn't find him again.
We're talking about places like Montevideo.
Oh, right? Everywhere. Anywhere. This could be UK, could be Canada, could be anywhere. It was always considered a challenge. And when he retired about 3 years ago, we had a little do for him. And the Rimi guys presented his wife with a notebook and a torch. She said, "What's that for?" And, "Well, you're on Parker watch now. This is to jot down where he goes, and this is the torch to try and find him at night." I think she managed to say that she would be able to keep an eye on him.
Great. Let's take a short break.
Yeah.
And do some more.
Sure.